Today, the theme of Brother Steve and Snowblind's classes is Biblical Perspectives on the Environment. His first class is entitled The Environment in the Book of Genesis.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure for myself and my family to be here. You've come up from Southern California, so we didn't have to worry about crossing any time zones to get here. And we bring with us the love and the greetings of your brothers and sisters down in the Los Angeles area. So, with respect to our theme, we find ourselves in a different kind of environment than we've been living in the last few weeks. And I find myself on academic sabbatical this year. Some of you may remember that in 07-08, we were here for most of the year. That was my first sabbatical. I mention this in part because we're going to be talking about the land sabbatical in our second talk, which coincidentally for me is aligned with my academic sabbatical. It's 14-15. Now, if you look at your schedule, I just want to give you a brief overview of what we're going to be doing this weekend. In part, I want to do this because some of the pieces of the puzzle, as it were, will only come into place by the time we get to the lecture, actually, on Sunday night. So what we want to do this afternoon is focus mostly on the Old Testament, beginning with the book of Genesis, in particular the Genesis account of creation, which, as we know, is a foundation for all the major doctrines in the Bible, is also a foundation for our theme this weekend. So that's where we will begin after I offer some introductory comments. We're going to look at the Law of Moses and some of the protocols in the Law of Moses and some of its teachings that relate to the management of the land, but also social justice themes. And as I'll explain in a few moments, social justice does relate to the environment in many ways, and certainly for us. We will spend some time talking about these themes as they appear in the prophets. My computer goes to sleep probably too quickly. There we go. And then for the adult Sunday school class, we will take this theme into the future and look at what the Bible says about the future of the environment, the future of the earth, the future of believers. And we'll see how this also connects to our overall theme. And it will also connect to what we're going to be talking about on Sunday night, Lord willing, when we have our lecture on the environmental crisis. And this is because there is a complaint that's made against Christianity and the Bible that Christianity and the Bible are somehow to blame for the environmental crisis. And I'm going to, when we get to the lecture, answer that question by saying, so the question would be, is Christianity to blame? Is the Bible to blame? I'm going to answer that question by saying that with respect to Christianity, the answer is yes and no. With respect to the Bible, the answer is no. But we need to build up to that. All right, now, a few other introductory comments. I need to, at the very beginning, just make it clear that when we use the term environment in this context, within our community, within the community of believers, the environment is a synonym for creation, right? So the environment's kind of a secular term. It's a term that people use commonly. It's obviously in the news a lot because of climate change and various other environmental issues. But for us, ultimately, the environment is creation. And so when the Bible talks about creation, it's talking about the environment. And the Bible says a lot about creation. And it also says a lot about the natural world. It says a lot about animals, etc. So the Bible has a lot to say on this theme of the environment or creation. We're only going to be able to touch on some of it. So, again, for us, the environment is creation with a capital C. Now, as I'm sure everyone is aware, there are many, many perspectives on the environment in the world today, including many that are destructive. And we'll talk a little bit about those destructive attitudes in the lecture on Sunday night. There are others, many, that attempt to develop positive, non-destructive attitudes towards the environment. Of these, some of them are secular. Some of them are what we could call neo-pagan. And some are Christian, but in many respects are unbiblical. So there's this kind of smorgasbord of options out there. But for the believer who wants a biblical perspective on the environment, we need to discern between what is biblical and what is not. So that's one of the things that will hopefully come out of these sessions. Now, we also have to remind ourselves that the Bible is an ancient document. So because of that, it's not designed, at least in the first instance, to speak to a people in the 21st century about science and environmental issues, etc. It's a theological text. It is a text that talks about God's purpose with the earth, that talks about human salvation, etc. Nevertheless, as I've already implied, its statements about the natural world, which we've said is creation, can act as environmental guides for environmental ethics for believers who hold the Bible to be the foundation of their faith. So it's an ancient text, but it has a lot of practical teaching about the environment that is every bit as valid today as it was when those portions of the Bible were first received. Now, when we think about environmental themes in the Bible, there are many approaches that we can take. But one thing we need to remember and bear in mind is that the environment is, or was, for the ancient Israelites, a very significant factor because they lived much closer to the land, to the natural world. The vast majority of them were involved in agricultural or pastoral activities. We're dealing with domestic animals, farm animals on a daily basis, etc. And so they were actually much closer to the environment than most 21st century people were. But more than that, it's useful to think about the sorts of environment that the people of the Bible lived in, because those environments actually had a shaping role on some of their activities, some of their attitudes, etc. And this also helps explain why we often see environmental and pastoral metaphors being used in the Bible, such as we see in Ezekiel 34, where God is described as a shepherd, and the people as his sheep. Hosea chapter 14, verses 6 to 7, speaks about Judah as a garden renewed by God. Right? So these metaphors would have meant a lot to the ancient Israelites, the ancient Judahites, because they were surrounded by the environment, they were living in it, in a way that we generally don't. Yes, we go out for hikes and nature and that sort of thing. But through our technology, through modern technology, we tend to be insulated from the effects of the environment in a way that ancient people were not. So the reality of the environment and its resources, often limited resources, are bound up with major themes and moments in the Bible. And I'll give you another example. We see in the account of Abraham and Lot's conflict over the grazing rights of their respective flocks. And this is described for us in Genesis 13. And they actually come to an agreement that their flocks together are too much of a burden for the land, that the land would not be able to bear that burden. So they decide to go to separate regions. And Lot, of course, takes the lush valley as his choice. And we see something similar happen in the case of Jacob and Esau. And this is found in Genesis chapter 36 and verses 6 to 8, where they realize that their herds are together too much for the land to bear, and so they decide that they have to separate. Now, obviously, there's a lot more to those stories than just the bearing ability of the land. But we can see in here, it's not the primary purpose of these accounts, but nevertheless, we can see the wisdom shown of these shepherds in desiring to avoid the overgrazing of the land. So there's another example where the environment is a factor and it becomes part of the storyline. Well, the account of the Exodus gives us many examples of the environment at work. Obviously, most dramatically, we have the 10 plagues of Egypt, most of which, all of which, to a certain degree, are related to the environment. And there's a larger story involved there when we think about the pantheon of Egyptian gods and how one of the things that the 10 plagues are doing is showing that Yahweh is the only true God and the other gods are non-existent. And then we have, of course, the Israelites in the wilderness, and they're being fed with manna and with quail. And so right out in the environment, obtaining their food. So we see this in the account of the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings. Many other examples in the Bible of drought and famine at the time of Elijah, and how this is very much a part of the story and part of the reality of life for those living in ancient Israel. They were often subjected to environmental catastrophes. When we go right to the end of the Bible, we see that even the book of Revelation is filled with environmental themes. And many of these, of course, are very dramatic. But as we'll see eventually, and we'll talk about this on Sunday morning, but also in our lecture on Sunday night, there are some positive environmental themes in the book of Revelation. All right, a few other summary points, and then we want to say a few things about Genesis before we conclude. God's care for animals is something we'll touch on again, I think, as well. But I just want to look at a couple of examples. Psalm 50 gives us our first example. And this is all part of building up a picture of what we're going to be saying throughout the weekend, that there is a God in heaven who has created this world, who cares for it on an ongoing basis, and that includes even the smallest animals. So in Psalm 50 and verses 10 and 11, we read, and this is God speaking, "For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills. I know all the birds of the hills, and all that moves in the field is mine." So we have this very clear sense that God is the creator, the sustainer, but God is also a caring God who loves his creation and cares for wild beasts as well as domestic animals, etc. And then if we move into the New Testament, we can see something similar in a memorable passage in Matthew chapter 10. Matthew 10 and 29. "Are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your father?" Right. So sparrow being a very, very small songbird, even the sparrow is a part of God's care for creation. Now, God, acts as a model, as we know, in the Bible for our own actions, our morality, our dealings with other people around us. And we can see examples of men and women in the Bible following this example of God, of caring for the environment, caring for animals. I'll just give you a very quick list of examples. Moses as a shepherd in Midian, Rebekah watering camels, Jacob as a shepherd in Aram or Syria and Canaan, David, of course, famously a shepherd in Israel. Christ is described as the good shepherd and the great shepherd of the sheep. That expression comes from Hebrews 13 and 20. So we see here a metaphor that's based on literal shepherding, which would have been very familiar to people, not only in the Old Testament, but also in the first century, the New Testament period. And we see a parable, like the parable of the lost sheep in Matthew 18, also in Luke 15, about saving a believer who's spiritually lost. But again, the metaphor is grounded in the literal caring for and concern for sheep. So this is another kind of vignette of what we see in the Bible, this example of people, men and women of God, who are caring for animals, caring for the environment. We can also see various places in the Bible, the garden mentioned, the garden as a place of delight, the garden as an ideal of nature. And we see in some of these cases a spiritual message. And one of them that you will all be familiar with is in Psalm 1. So in Psalm 1, we have this description of the godly person. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. And here we have the analogy to the tree. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. And we see this language picked up in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah 17 and verse 8 as well. So again, a metaphor, this case about a tree. And of course, in that part of the world, many trees did grow beside waters, because in an arid climate, this is one place where you would generally see trees. So it's something that the ancient Israelites would have understood, and that would have given them more insight into the spiritual meaning. A couple other examples. In the book of Ecclesiastes 2 and 5, we see whomever the writer of Ecclesiastes is, let's just say Solomon, describing the planting of trees. And there are various places in the Bible where we actually see this. We'll touch on a few other examples a little bit later today. But tree planting, right? The wilderness is a place of peace, a place to go when one wants peace. Well, we see this in the life of Christ, right? When Jesus goes into the wilderness, Luke chapter 5 and verse 16 is an example. We see Jesus resorting to the wilderness for prayer. So this is another example of how nature is portrayed in the Bible. There are significant gardens in the Bible. The first one, of course, is the Garden of Eden. We often say the Garden of Eden, but actually it's the Garden in Eden. Eden is a larger territory. Gethsemane, the place where Jesus had his final battle with the flesh, as it were. The site of the crucifixion itself was near a garden, and of course his tomb was. And you will remember that when he was resurrected, he was actually mistaken for the gardener. And right to the end of the Bible, the book of Revelation, Revelation 22, the beginning of the chapter, which we're going to talk about later this weekend, we see language that is very similar to what we see in Psalm 1, a river and trees, etc. So, the Bible begins with a garden, and it ends with a garden. Christ's victory over sin and death happened in gardens. God, as we'll see in a few moments, is a gardener. We can see this from the Genesis account of creation, because God is described as planting trees in the Garden of Eden. Adam, of course, himself is a gardener. He's given this mandate to care for the garden. And as I've just mentioned, the risen Christ is mistaken for a gardener. Some other examples. We see garden imagery used extensively in the Song of Solomon and also throughout the Hebrew prophets. All right, now switching gears a little bit, I mentioned a few minutes ago social justice. Right, this is a big theme, in particular, in the Hebrew prophets, but it goes right back to the books of Moses as well. And the environment and social justice are linked. They're linked in very real ways. So concern about the environment can motivate the believer to turn to the Bible for guidance on not only how we deal with the environment, how we care for the environment, etc., but also social justice issues. So how ought we to act in ethically in creation and also with our neighbor? Are we taking more of the earth's resources than we should? Do our actions in any way cause less fortunate people to suffer or to lose out? Right, these are social justice issues. And as we've seen over the last few decades with the environmental crisis, it's often the poor who suffer the most from environmental degradation. So the environment is linked very firmly with extremely important moral issues. We can't escape that. Something else that is important to bear in mind is that the environment as a theme in the Bible links up with and helps support various important biblical teachings. So a close examination of environmental themes in the Bible demonstrates that they interact with the teachings of the doctrine of creation, what the Bible tells us about the providence and the sovereignty of God, the nature of the human. This is something we're going to talk about over the next few classes. And as part of that, the doctrine of bodily resurrection, the renewal of the earth, and the future of the earth and humanity upon it. These are doctrines, prophetic teachings, etc., that all link with environmental themes. And at the same time, or conversely, we could say, unbiblical doctrine about humanity and the earth and their future can be associated with uncaring attitudes toward the environment. So we'll touch on this a little bit this afternoon, but we're going to return to it when we have our lecture, Lord willing, on Sunday. Now, I've alluded earlier to this criticism, very common criticism, that one of the reasons why we're in an environmental crisis is because of Christianity or because of the Bible. And in particular, people will zero in on Genesis chapter 1, which we just had read, the granting of dominion to human beings. So this is seen by many people as a kind of license given to humanity to despoil the earth. Now, obviously, some people believe the Bible is inspired by God. Many people don't. So for those who don't believe that the Bible is inspired by God, they're not going to argue that, you know, this is actually God commanding humans to have dominion. But it's actually an unfortunate idea that uninspired writers put in the text that's had unfortunate consequences for many millennia. So we're going to deal with this particularly on Sunday night. But much of what we say up till that point will help show the problems with that particular argument. But it's very important that we know that that argument exists. Some of you may have encountered it. I've encountered it many times myself. It's in literature about the environment, but you'll often hear people who are involved in the environmental movement making claims like that, that there's some inherent problem in the way that the Bible describes humanity's relationship with the earth that has actually precipitated the environmental crisis. Now, ironically, and this is very ironic, those who make that argument, who don't believe in the Bible, are actually, in a way, arguing that the Bible is very powerful, right? That it actually has that kind of effect. But we're going to show that there are problems with this interpretation. So this interpretation relies on the notion of dominion, which we've just read about in Genesis chapter 1, as exploitative domination. Right, so that's the interpretation. That dominion there means exploitative domination, that humanity has the right to pillage and despoil and abuse the earth in whatever way he wants to. Right? But we're going to argue this is actually a very unbiblical reading of the creation account. The creation account instead points to a different model, and that is benevolent stewardship. And this is something we're going to touch on several times throughout the weekend. In general, a careful reading of the Bible shows many examples of positive views of the environment, which is to be respected and preserved precisely because it is God's creation, right? This is something we always need to remember, that the created world around us, or the world around us, is just that, the created world. It is God's creation. So do we want to be in a situation where we are abusing or destroying God's creation? And that's something that we need to keep in mind all the time when we think ethically about how we operate in this world. Now, it has to be said that in general, environmental ethics have remained for many years a kind of neglected aspect of the study of the Bible. And this is probably because in the wider society, there's been this kind of ecological myopia. And although it's to our shame, often it takes, a kind of a crisis before we start to notice an additional richness to the Bible. And certainly if you were to do some research on this and look for scholarship and other books, you would have no problem finding lots of books written in particular by evangelical authors on the environment. So I've got one here called Let Creation Rejoice, Biblical Hope and Ecological Crisis, and another one by a scholar from Scotland, The Bible and Ecology. And there are many more where those ones came from. Now, I mentioned earlier that one of the things we need to do when we're analyzing these arguments is to discern what is biblical and what isn't. And one of the things that's really quite remarkable about a lot of this literature is that these scholars are ending up in places very similar to where we would end up in terms of doctrine. So, for example, you'll find that a lot of these scholars who are looking at what the Bible says about the environment are concluding that human beings don't have immortal souls. How does that relate to the environment? Well, I'm going to explain that as we move on. And you'll also see that a lot of these scholars are saying, you know, when we talk about going to heaven, the believer is going to go to heaven, or that the earth is going to be destroyed, right? Those ideas actually can have a very damaging effect on people's views of the environment, right? Because if you think the earth is going to be destroyed, then who cares about whether we're, burning up fossil fuels and polluting the atmosphere and polluting the earth, etc. It's going to be destroyed anyways, right? Or if we believe that our future in the afterlife is somewhere in heaven, not on earth, then, the earth maybe is not that important. Now, of course, that's not what we believe. We don't believe that because that's not what the Bible teaches. But it's really interesting to see how scholarship has moved in a direction that finds them basically in the same place as we have been for many, many years. So this is something I think that we shouldn't gloat about, but certainly it's a topic that will allow us to engage with other people that we know, particularly if we have Christian colleagues or friends. Okay, so those are just some introductory comments. We're supposed to stop at 2:45. So I'll just say a little bit about Genesis, and then we'll have our break, and then we will pick up the theme from there. All right. Now, I've already hinted at this, but when we look at the Bible as a whole, but the Genesis account of creation in particular, which we're going to start talking about now, we're not looking at science. We're not looking at a science textbook. We're not looking at a textbook that's designed to tell us about ecology in a modern sense. It's not a philosophy of nature. It's not that kind of thing at all. What we're dealing with in the Bible, but in the book of Genesis in particular, is a theology of nature, right? Now, this doesn't mean that it has no value to us in practical terms, because as we're going to see, there is a lot of value when we understand these theological teachings as they intersect with the reality of creation around us. So again, it's just a very important point that we shouldn't approach the Bible expecting it to speak in scientific language. It's not inconsistent with science. It's just a different kind of language. It's like comparing a science text with poetry, right? They speak in different kinds of terms, and you need to come to them and approach them with different expectations. All right, so we'll just start up our discussion of the environment in the book of Genesis. And one of the things that Genesis does for us and provides as a foundation for the rest of the Bible is it establishes a worldview. Right? Now, this is something that works for us today, but it also was very important to the original recipients of the book of Genesis in ancient Israel. Because, of course, they were surrounded by different kinds of worldview. So here's a list of various worldviews that have been presented over the years. Obviously, another worldview would be the atheistic worldview, but that's not really in view in the biblical period. So animism is the idea that there's a kind of a soul in nature, that even rocks kind of have a soul. Polytheism, of course, is the idea that there are many gods, not one god. And one of the things we see in the Genesis account of creation very clearly is that the unity of God, that there is only one God, underpins the unity of creation. And when you look at the history of science and the development of notions like laws of nature and the universality of those laws of nature, they're bound up with the monotheistic culture of Europe during the scientific revolution. So there's actually a connection between this biblical view of things, where we see laws mentioned, we see this in the book of Jeremiah about the moon, etc., but also what we see in the book of Genesis. Gnosticism is another worldview that emerges towards the end of the New Testament period and kind of begins to become a major teaching in the second century. And this is an idea that the physical world is actually evil. And not only that, but it's created by an evil God, right? And therefore, what we want to do is we want to escape this evil world, this physical world. We want to escape our bodies, which are physical and are evil. And so Gnosticism has this very strongly dualistic view of things, that the world is evil, and we want to escape it. Now, this is an idea that emerges outside of Christianity, but it actually comes to have a very important shaping role on the history of Christian doctrine, where we begin to see notions like the immortality of the soul creeping into the church, and this belief that we're going to exit the earth, we're going to go to heaven, etc. It's very similar to this Gnostic idea. What we've just read in the book of Genesis is that the world is good, right? Six times God saw that it was good. And then the final time, very good, right? Not perfect, but good, right? So one of the things that Genesis tells us is that this world is good. It's not evil. It's certainly not created by an evil God. Deism is the idea that there is a God who created everything, but that God is not interested in an ongoing relationship with this world and is not interested in an ongoing relationship with individuals. Well, that's not the God of the Bible, because the God of the Bible yes, created the world, but as we'll see, is interested in having an ongoing relationship with the natural world and with human beings. Pantheism is the idea that there's no distinction between God and nature, so that nature is God, God is nature, etc. Well, that's obviously not in view because when we look at the Genesis account of creation and the rest of the Bible, there's a very, very clear separation made between God, who is transcendent, and creation, which is just that, a creation of God. So what we see in the Bible is what I've called here biblical theism, the idea that there is a God who creates and who sustains, a God who operates through providence and through his sovereignty on an ongoing basis, continually upholding creation and overseeing human affairs, although allowing a free will within that sphere of influence. Okay, why don't we break here, and when we recommence, we'll say a bit more about Genesis, and then we'll move on to the Law of Moses.